Well, let's this morning start at the very end, actually. Just turn over a couple of pages to the last line of this letter, to chapter 5, to verse 21, where wise Uncle John, as his readers may well have thought of their apostle, writes and sums up what he's saying to them. And he just writes this sentence: "Dear children, keep yourselves from idols." And you think, if that's what this is all about, well, you're rolling your eyes and trying to get comfortable, you know, a morning wasted on some far-fetched danger of all souls being turned into the likes of a Buddhist shrine or a Hindu temple or an Islamic mosque. Well, there are churches and chapels in this country where that has happened. But what if the danger John is writing about is rather different from that, rather closer to home? You know, you may well have noticed there are buildings all around the area here that are being redeveloped. Many of them listed buildings of historical or architectural importance. They get gutted completely and rebuilt, but they often have to retain the facade. Sometimes it's a one brick thick facade. So that when the scaffolding comes down and the cladding is taken away, the building looks just the same as it always did. But when you go through the front door, it's completely different. What if that's what Satan's scheming? A Christianity without its apostolic content. A Christian facade, but the content's all reshaped. See, here's a leader in a major Christian denomination in the West. He said, the doctrine of the ascension can't survive the Copernican revolution, the discovery that we don't live in a three-tier universe. Darwinism demolishes original sin and the fall of man. We're evolving higher and higher. Therefore, Jesus as a sacrifice for sin makes no sense. It's a repellent image. Jesus is not a redeemer, a rescuer, but God calling us to deeper and fuller humanity beyond divisions. Well, there's a bishop speaking. No fall, no sin, no atonement, presumably no resurrection because certainly no ascension, and yet no rebranding, no new logo, still the Christian church facade. It's Satan's masterpiece. Actually, he said that about 20 years ago. Now it's the ethical and moral furniture that's all being rearranged. Christianity without its apostolic content. That is the idolatry that John's writing to counter. So as you come back to the beginning of his letter, to where we're going to be focused, as you read, as you do in verses 6 and 8 and 10, if we claim this, if we claim that, if we claim the other. It's not John's imagination at work. It's because people were claiming those things. And he's writing to a church that's just experienced a split. And those who've left haven't turned atheists. They've not abandoned God. They believe in him still. They claim to know him. Indeed, they claim to be the ones with the real spiritual experience. And John writes to those who are left behind. He writes into their confusion. Who is really in fellowship with God, them or us? Which group is right? And if the church people can't work it out, what chance does the outsider looking in have of sorting out how to know God and be in relationship with him? Well, John faces that kind of confusion with the confidence of his opening paragraph. And he points to several key facts. Here's the first. The life appeared. You see how he begins the letter, that which was from the beginning. He's claiming to have got his hands on an original. You know, there's nothing second-hand about this. So what was from the beginning? Well, in the beginning, God. That's how the Bible starts, Genesis 1:1. In the beginning was the Word. John had borrowed that start for his gospel as he introduced Jesus. And he echoes it again here. God, the Word, Jesus, the Word of life. As you read John's letter, it seems at times as if he's speaking of a thing. That which. A message, perhaps. That which we've heard, we proclaim to you. At other times, it's as if he's speaking of a person. Someone we've seen and touched. The Word of Life. And in John's writing, Jesus is both the Word and the Life. And John writes here as if the message and the person were one. You can't divorce the two. As we'll see, the message has the power for life which Jesus has, which God has. And here's the truth. At the heart of it all, here is Christmas in three words. There in verse 2, do you see? The life appeared. Something hidden's been revealed. The God, the Jesus, the life has appeared and could be, according to verse 1, heard and seen and looked at and touched. God's taken steps to make himself known. He's not distant, remote, out of reach. He's not playing hide and seek. I had a new grandchild a few weeks back, and the other day I was visiting, and I was playing with the older boys, and my three-year-old grandson said, "Let's play hide-and-seek, Grandpa." So we had to play hide-and-seek in his bedroom. There's nowhere to hide in his bedroom, to be honest. But he picked up the duvet, and clearly he was going to hide under the duvet, so I dutifully did the grandfatherly thing and counted up to a certain number. And, you know, ready or not, I'm coming. It was very obvious where the slightly quivering duvet was on the floor over there, but I dutifully looked in the cupboard. Oh no, he's not there. Open the drawers and he's not there. Bigger giggles every time I did it. Finally I find him, he's ecstatic, and he says, "You hide now, Grandpa." There's even less room for me to hide, and I can only just get under the duvet. I said, "Well, how much are you going to count up to?" "One," he said. I said, "Okay, you close your eyes. Can't do that, Grandpa." So with his eyes open, he counts to one. And he knows the game by now. And he too, I'm under the duvet fairly obviously. He too goes to the cupboard. He doesn't remember the words, but he makes all the noises. "Oh, oh." Opens the drawers. "Oh, oh." Finally finds me under the duvet. Well, you know, we have this game for a while, and it's great fun, and he loves it. You see, I think I'm playing hide-and-seek, where the object is to hide and stay hidden. He's really playing find and be found. Because the greatest moment is when he's found. Why is God the Father allowed his son to be examined like a prized exhibit in a museum, you know, heard, seen, looked at, touched? Why? Because he wants to be found. Because he wants his life to be discovered. The life appeared to be heard and seen and looked at and touched. Christmas is, it's like a tiger volunteering to go into a zoo and exchange the wild freedom for a cage. It's like an adult becoming a baby again. You know, vulnerable, dependent. You say, at least the baby's got a future. Yes, but the future for this baby was not going to be just being touched, but being mauled and flogged and nailed to a cross. And he is the life. And verse 7 tells me, his blood purifies us from all sin. The life appeared. So to speak as if we can't know God and we're going to have to guess about him, to talk as if, the way I see it is a huge insult. To a God who's gone to those lengths to reveal himself, has sent that kind of message. The life appeared. Here is hope for the confused. God once sent a very clear message. Now, we weren't there at the time. We're too young. But if only someone had been and had left a reliable record, then we might know how to be in relationship with God. Then we might be able to clear up the muddle over who is and who isn't. Which brings us to the other fact staring us in the face in this paragraph. Not just that the life appeared, but the word proclaimed. That's where it's heading, of course, but John begins with those who do the proclaiming. The we and the us scattered throughout the paragraph actually form something of an exclusive club. They were there. They were eyewitnesses and ear witnesses. You see how verse 1 begins? That which was from the beginning, which we have heard, which we have seen with our eyes, which we have looked at. And that looked at word means not just to see, but to see and understand, to take in the meaning. Some of you will remember in John's Gospel on Easter Sunday when John and Peter raced to the tomb after the women has reported it empty, and John wins the race and records it. You know, he reached the tomb first. It's all right, ladies, but that's a very important fact for us men to make sure you understand who gets there first. When Peter, puffing and panting, gets there and goes straight inside, finally, John tells us, the other disciple who had reached the tomb first, in case you'd forgotten that he'd said that a line earlier, he went inside and he saw and believed. He saw and understood. That's the sense of we have looked at and got the meaning. And our hands have touched. And that word hasn't got the sense of just a sort of poke where you touch and then pull your finger away. It's much more the idea of fumbling for something in the dark. And when you're fumbling in the dark and you find something, you know, you check all over that you've got it just right, don't you? A blind person feeling for the shape and the texture of an object. This we proclaim concerning the word of life. See, these people know what they're talking about. The message gets the flavor of this paragraph when it puts it like this. We were there taking it all in. We heard it with our own ears. We saw it with our own eyes. We verified it with our own hands. And now we're telling you. It's the mark of an apostle, actually, to be in that position. Do you remember the moment at the beginning of the book of Acts when they're looking to replace Judas as one of the 12 apostles and they start to work through the qualifications needed? What kind of person do we need? And this is what they say to themselves. Therefore, it's necessary to choose one of the men who've been with us the whole time the Lord Jesus was living among us, beginning from John's baptism to the time when Jesus was taken up from us. For one of these must become a witness with us of his resurrection. See how very insistent they were that these original apostles are qualified to speak of Jesus, competent as witnesses to him. Well, John, at the outset of his letter, writes as one of those. Someone who can speak with the knowledge, as the taxi drivers might put it, the knowledge of an eyewitness here. Now, none of us today could write this paragraph, could we? We weren't there. He was. Now, I go on about this because a recent survey of what we think about Jesus in this country reveals that 22%, 25% if you're in the 18 to 34 age bracket, think Jesus was a mythical or fictional character. Do you think they realize? We've evidence from those who heard, saw, looked at, touched the real, live, historical Jesus. Of course, I know we sometimes say, you know, if I could have seen it myself, then I might believe. But we don't actually do that with the rest of history. We don't do that with the rest of life. Old though I am, I never saw the First World War. I wasn't around in the Second World War either, come to that. And I'm very happy not to have experienced them. I don't need that to believe they happened. Plenty of eyewitness accounts to go on. Well, we've got them for Jesus too. And John writes as part of the eyewitness expert group, the we at the heart of this paragraph, but This life they've witnessed isn't restricted to them. It's passed on to the other group mentioned here, you, the readers, any readers. See, and there's the thrust of what's happening here, isn't it? Verse 1, this we proclaim concerning the word of life. And that proclaim word speaks of commissioned people with a job to speak. The life they've experienced is not for hoarding, but for passing on. Or verse 2, we proclaim to you the eternal life which was with the Father and has appeared to us. Verse 3, we proclaim to you what we have seen and heard. If there's confusion about God and Jesus and life, these are the people I want to make sure I'm listening to. I want to make sure I can not just be in touch with them, but in tune with them, these eyewitness experts and what they have to say. The life appeared, and they saw it. The word proclaimed, and they're the ones in a position to tell of him. But there is one more important step to notice, what I've called the joy complete. See, it's what he writes of in verse 4. We write this to make our joy complete. What John is saying here is that joy is not complete with his experience of Jesus, wonderful though that was. And actually, it's not even complete with proclaiming Jesus either. As if, you know, it was one of those messages delivered where you get the signature to show you've received it, and then it's job done, box ticked, joy complete. I was looking for more than that. I was given a wonderful treat yesterday. A friend took me down to see my favourite football team play. We saw them play in their relatively new stadium I'd never been to before. I have never seen them play and win. I haven't seen them play that often, but in over just about 60 years, I've never seen them play and win. And I was taken down there, and I realized as the game started that nothing was about to change. After 5 minutes, they were 2-0 down. Now, by half time, they could have been 3 or 4-0 down. My friend it's Brighton. I'm sorry, in case you hadn't already worked it out. It is Brighton that is the team. And my friend, I thought, was getting remarkably passionate about the game. And he's no Brighton supporter. He's a Chelsea supporter. Poor guy. But I wonder why he was so emotional. And then I discovered that Rico Tice had said to him that I have never seen Brighton win, and his job was to take me to a game where, you know, I would see them win, and whatever happens. And he was getting increasingly frightened of what he was going to have to report back to Rico, and what would be the result there. So he was getting more and more emotionally bound up in the game. He needn't have worried, of course. 3 second half goals, 2 in something like the final 5 minutes, sorted it all out, 3-2, we won, that's it. Now, I'm telling you this, and I'll tell anyone else who wants to hear about it, I'm quite happy about it, but don't worry, you don't need to get excited hearing this to make my joy complete. My joy was complete in the 87th minute when we scored the winner, or a few minutes later when the final whistle went and left Brighton, as they have been for many weeks now, the only unbeaten side in the 4 major football leagues at the moment. I just thought you ought to learn something new this morning. You see, I don't need your buy-in to be excited and my joy to be complete. But just the telling of it is not enough for John. Now he says, it's joy complete when this life is yours as well as ours. See, look at verse 3. We proclaim to you what we have seen and heard. And I would have finished the sentence, so that you may have fellowship with the Father and with the Son. And that is where John is heading. But that's not how he puts it, is it? He's emphasizing the route we take to get there. And it's both striking and vital to see that route. Look again at verse 3, will you? Take it in, because it isn't obvious. We proclaim to you what we've seen and heard, so that you also may have fellowship with us. And our fellowship is with the Father and with his Son, Jesus Christ. We're passing on the message, John writes, so that you come into relationship with us. And if you do that, you come into the circle which is in relationship with God Himself, the Father and the Son, the fellowship the Spirit provides. And maybe it'll make the point more helpfully if I use a diagram or two to illustrate. See, many imagine that a relationship with God comes from some kind of hotline experience, as if there's just a straight vertical line of communication between God and us. It's great, really. It cuts out any middleman. God will communicate and I'll know Him, and we can put all kinds of labels on it. We can speak about a mystical experience, maybe a dream, a vision. I don't know what some people expect. I can remember one city businessman who said he believed all the truths of the gospel. He says, "I'm just waiting for God to zap me." And our response, I don't know, some people speak about a feeling, an intuition, and others of, "I haven't had that, so I can't believe. You know, I wish I had your faith," as if it was some kind of germ you catch. We love the idea of this direct route. But John is describing something different. John's describing something that's more like this, isn't he? A God who appeared to the apostles, who proclaimed what they had seen and heard to us. We're not now having to sift through the confusion of an ever-expanding myriad of experiences to discover the truth about God, Jesus, life, but listen instead to one collective, one group, the apostles, with eyewitness experience of when that life appeared. "We proclaim to you what we have seen and heard." Why? "So that you also may have fellowship with us." How does that work? How do you come into relationship with a bunch of long-dead apostles? Well, as you embrace the message they proclaim, as you line up alongside them, as you stand shoulder to shoulder with them in the confusion of voices about things spiritual. And as I do that, I share their fellowship and relationship with God the Father and God the Son. You come into fellowship with us, and our fellowship is with the Father and with the Son. Well, even now, if we come into fellowship like that, it'll bring a smile to the face of the apostles, a smile of mission accomplished, completed joy. We write this to make our joy complete. Actually, in one of his later letters, John will echo that thought again. He says, "I've no greater joy than to hear that my children are walking in the truth." I wonder if you know that truth. I wonder if you know that joy. Maybe biological children like Abigail and Chibuezi. Maybe our spiritual children, those we've helped to faith, we've supported and encouraged in it. And sometimes when folk are going through tough times, you know, maybe health, maybe finances, maybe relationships, we sometimes say, don't we, you know, at least they're walking with the Lord. Actually, John reminds me, we should be saying, most importantly, they're walking with the Lord. Most wonderfully, they're walking with the Lord. Our joy is complete. Life appeared. Word proclaimed. Joy complete. Here's the test of your faith. See, John isn't gullible. He knows people can be deceived and not have the truth in them, whatever claims they make. And he says that very bluntly in these opening paragraphs in verse 6, in verse 8, in verse 10. The truth is not in us. The truth is not in us. The truth is not in us. And yet at the same time, he's not dismissive of claims to know God. He's not saying there's no such thing as mystical experiences and dreams and visions. They may be real. I know several Muslims who've been pointed to the Lord by dreams. But John insists that the test is the test of being in line with us, as John puts it, the eyewitnesses. That if claims about knowing God don't survive the test of fellowship with the apostles, then it's not fellowship with the Father and the Son that we're enjoying. The writers of this group had left. You know, he writes of the group that had left his readers. Well, if you turn over a page, you'll see it in chapter 2 and verse 19. And he says this. And he picks up the same idea. They went out from us because they didn't really belong to us. For if they belonged to us, they would have remained with us, but their going showed none of them belonged to us. It's why we read our Bibles regularly. It's why we'll open them and explore them when we come together like this, because we don't want to live in a Christian facade and discover when you walk through the front door all the ideas we've built up about God and Jesus and our Christian faith are unrecognizable to those who heard, saw, looked at, touched the Word of Life Himself. We always need to keep applying this test. Is that idea in line with those who saw and knew? Some, maybe this morning particularly, need to ask yourself the question, is your faith in line with the apostles' testimony? Dear children, keep yourselves from idols. It's the test of your faith. It's also the confidence you can have in your faith. You know, some of us will have known this experience. You feel you've kind of missed out on the deep experiences some people speak of. You wished you'd had them. You can easily become dispirited as you hear their excited talk. And actually, I can be so full of what I've not got that I forget what I do have. John tells me, if my faith is in line with his, our fellowship is with the Father and with his Son, Jesus Christ. I am in relationship with God. Here's how I can wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning. You know, I can be overwhelmed by life's burdens. If you wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning, night has a tendency to do that to you, doesn't it? It gets everything out of perspective. It may be illness, it may be tragedy in the family or friends, it may be pressures of work or lack of it, it may just be weariness of spirit. I can wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning, I can read the Bible, I can discover nothing has changed. I can tell myself, I am in fellowship with the Father and the Son. That relationship is still mine. Encourage yourself with that. Your faith has substance. It's not mere facade. You don't need to look elsewhere to fill it. Keep yourselves from idols.